Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Stay Report. I'm your host, Devin Decker, and joining me, my host companion, Sejan Sarawick. Sejan?
Hey, man. What is going on? I calling you now after the last week, I just can't believe we're still on the internet. I would have been convinced by now that anonymous hackers would have taken us down.
Dude, the hack that occurred last week, right? What the internet looked like last week is the very reason why we are recording on our usual Monday time slot.
Yeah.
Because I felt like we got caught with our pants down by doing a Sunday recording early, and then suddenly the world goes to shit, and it's like, well, we can't report on it. A, because the world has gone to shit. We literally can't connect to each other right now. But then B, we already did an episode, and like, this is not just mini episode worthy. Like, this deserves a full-on episode discussion.
Yeah, it's so weird, right? I feel like since the events of last week... So for anybody that doesn't know, we were recording this the week after Facebook went down for, 6 hours when all was said and done? 7 hours?
About 7 hours, I think. I'd say seven. Even if it were, six and a half, seven feels closer to what it felt like.
Followed very quickly by all of a sudden the news that Twitch had a humongous data breach, and not just like I know I said the word humongous and that sounds like hyperbole, but legitimately like all users' information is just out there now.
125 gigabits of information.
Yeah, that's
which was
is
released.
Not significant when you're talking about internet and info, yeah.
Including the entire site map, like how they built it, the source code of Twitch was released,
which related to what happened with Facebook. A lot of the stuff that was going down and a lot of the things that were happening it is speculated that the only way that you could really do the damage that was done to Facebook on Monday of last week, on what was it, October 1st,
October 4th.
Fourth, thanks. Yeah. All right. Make sure we get that date down. So what happened to Facebook on October 4th in 2021? Like that information could only be understood and attacked and damaged by someone that knew the same information that was then leaked to Twitch the next day. So understandably, people were like freaked out when Twitch was like, a bunch of our information got out, including source code information and things like this. And it's not that it was the same type of attack at all. It's just that the information that got out in the Twitch leak is the kind of information that would then be needed to perform the kind of attack that was then performed on Facebook. And even using the word attack is speculation, because at this point, the way that Facebook's talking about it is somebody tripped over a power cord somewhere and it popped out of the socket. Like the way that they're acting is like, this is the most nonchalant thing in the world. The actual words being used by Facebook employees on that day was, we're just calling this a snow day. Like, everybody's just chill, everyone's relaxing, everything's fine. Despite the fact that, like, some serious shit was going down, right?
I mean, that's propaganda 101, that everything is fine, go on about your business.
I can't believe how well it worked, is really, though, right? Is like, at the end of the day, like, we had that happen, followed by Twitch, and then for days, it was like, nobody was talking about it anymore. Like, it had just gone away. And it was the weirdest thing in the world, because, like, I was like, guys, now is the time to debrief, right? Like, now is the time where we all talk about it. I have seen, you know, one or two people on Twitter and stuff like that, funny enough, being like, go and erase your Facebook accounts. What happened this week? Cannot stand. But they're like lone voices in the woods, as far as I can tell, right? It wasn't until I had my own internet issues this weekend that I finally was just like, this is it. This is the end, right? Because then I don't know what happened in northwestern, specifically Utah, but Comcast Xfinity just decided it was just going to have a major outage starting at,
I think they call it a snow day.
Yeah, right. And then it started at 11 p.m. on Saturday night for me, and they said at that time we'll have this fixed by 3 a.m. Not too unusual for Comcast. That's a pretty normal window for when there's an outage around here. But when I woke up the next morning and there still wasn't internet, and they still were saying we don't know what's going on, then a few hours later, my entire Comcast owned like router setup completely factory reset itself. I didn't know what was going on. right? And at some point, we realized that the internet had been back on for who knows how long. The problem that we were then having in the house was we are on a Google Nest system. And so what that means is there is a literal like web throughout the house of little Nest hubs that pick up the internet. And it just means that we get the best Wi-Fi signal anywhere we possibly can inside of the house. And for us, since we're in such a small house, outside of the house too. So like in the garage and in the yard and stuff like that too. So it's an awesome setup. But what we didn't realize was that because of the factory reset on the Comcast material, the Nest hubs were suddenly like, we don't know who to talk to anymore. We don't trust that guy, that new guy in the house. So once we had gone back into the router after the factory reset and done a couple of like updates there to get it back to where it was, the Nest hubs clicked in instantly and knew what it was, and we were back to full internet within like 20 minutes. But I didn't think about that until 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon for us here. And by the time I was done, 4 o'clock in the afternoon was when we were finally back up on our feet. But the internet could have been back as early as when that reset happened at like 10 a.m. But like Comcast didn't contact us. They didn't say, hey, this is going to cause this issue. Make sure you do A, B, and C. Like,
I mean, you I say that, but Comcast might have tried to contact you, but
well, we sent you an email.
What are you talking about?
It's this, oh man, it's crazy because it really made me realize how fragile the whole thing really is after a week of already kind of teetering on the edge of that conversation. And like, it made me really think about the fact that like, no matter what kind of leaps and bounds we made over the last 2 years with everybody starting to work from home, the conversation about things like, hey, maybe we need to really focus on like data caps and internet capability and internet deserts and things like that in this country. Like maybe we need to have a serious conversation about that. And everybody kind of shook their head in agreement, but it never fucking happened. And so here we are in this last week, and now everybody's like losing their crap again. And it's just like we learned nothing from the last 2 years when we became so dependent on this thing and kept telling each other we were going to get around to reading the manual, but then nobody ever did.
Right. I mean, but the problem is, the real issue with that is, as important as strengthening internet infrastructure is, there are a lot of other very weak infrastructures in America that are more closely related to making sure that you get votes in November.
More
is how I'm going to put
more,
that.
Yeah, they are more visible to the average voter. So, like, the truth of the matter is at the end of the day, this internet thing is a thing that kind of affects all of us. So really working on it is something that's really key and important when you think about it. But if you don't think about it, it's not something that you focus on all day. I mean, like, I shamefully admit that it took me way too long to figure out that was why we didn't have internet for probably 3 or 4 hours on Sunday, was because I didn't think about the fact that the internet system that I had set up had not been properly communicating with the one that it should have been. And like, as a guy that works in IT, I'm kicking myself. I should have realized immediately when that thing reset itself that I was going to have to look into it and make sure that everything else was up to snuff. And like, that's saying something, right? That me as a guy that sits down and does this exact stuff with customers all day, every day for my job, didn't think of that for like hours into the day. And so I'm kicking myself for that, but I'm also kind of like, man, this should be something that everybody should be knowing how to do. And I think about the fact that this is me in my house, but I know for a fact that people didn't have internet across the street. I know for the fact people didn't have internet down the road. Like there are people around here that I'm now thinking probably still don't know that their internet's back, because whatever systems they have in place probably aren't working right.
I mean, you say that, but the type of person who would not know that their internet is back because of the systems they set up, the way that you did it, they're probably the type of people who only go with what Comcast gave them. I mean, like,
yeah,
not to like throw any shade or anything, but
no, but if their TV was talking to that, and their TV now doesn't know because the Netgear box that I have no longer has the name, that the funny name that I put on it with the password that I put on it. That's what I had to reset, right? And for me, everything in the house is connected to the Nest. So once the Nest was set up to talk to the Netgear box again, everything in the house came back instantly. But if I didn't have the Nest, I would have had to go to every individual device to give it the new name and password to that system. And if I don't know that, if I'm, say, the 90-year-old woman that lives next door to me that I'm pretty sure is bedridden and just has, like, a nurse come over once every couple of days to just make sure she's still alive, like, if she doesn't know that she now needs to go back into her TV and tell it, hey, talk to my new thing this way, then they don't know that. So they could even go through the effort of learning to fix the Netgear box, fix that themselves, be super proud of themselves because they don't usually do this thing. They usually call grandson to do it. And then suddenly, like, they fix that and it didn't fix the problem in the house. I could easily see people out there that are still probably dealing with this, not 48 hours later, right?
You're not wrong. Like, you know what I'm going to say, though? My first thought jumps to when I first received my own, like, Fios modem, right? Because mm-hmm. we were on Cox for a while, and that our Cox internet, Cox's local internet, in case you're not familiar, we have basically Cox and Verizon in Rhode Island. And Cox is what we had for a long time. And Cox was not good, is the easiest way that I can put it. They gave you a modem, but they didn't give you anything. At the time, when we had gotten it, they didn't give you any way to do Wi-Fi. Like, I had to set up my own Wi-Fi network inside the house. And I'm talking early days of Wi-Fi before it had a catchy tune, right? Yeah, like, it was wireless internet.
I want you to finish your point, but I long for those days, and we'll talk about that in
right,
a second.
No, and like, I totally understand that. I totally understand that. But I'd been going out into the world, right? Because we just lived with the Cox for however long that we just stayed with Cox Internet. And it was this cobbled together wireless network, basically so I could use my laptop in the house without being plugged in. That's right. All it did. It was specifically just for me. It wasn't until we all got smartphones in this house in like 2014, I think, is when the whole Decker family caught up to that movement. Yep. And that was when we also got Verizon because it was cheaper than Cox and we got more. And that's when we got the modem box. And up to that point, I would go over to people's houses and they'd be like, oh, you can get on the Wi-Fi network. And I'm like, oh, what's the password? And they're like, oh, the router is over there. The password is on the back of the router.
Right.
And I'm like, well, that's, first of all, I guess that's nice because you just say that to people, right? And they know it, but that's a little inconvenient, right? Like, that's just how these work. That doesn't seem right. And then I got my gross, like, scarlet red giant Wi-Fi modem combination from Verizon. Yeah. And on the back, it has, here's your network name. Here's the password to access it. And I'm like, oh, okay, I guess that's just how we live now. And then I read down a little lower and it's like, here's how you identify this as your own and make it unique. And like, these were people who like were computer gamers. These were people who built their own PCs. And I'd go to their houses and they would be like, yeah, the Wi-Fi password's on the back of the modem. You just have to go over there and like dig a little bit and you can get it. So, like, why didn't they set up their own network name and their own password for their Wi-Fi network?
Yeah.
So, the thought process is, and again, this was, 7 years ago at this point, that, like, that was the norm everywhere that I went. But there are still probably people who never fuck with that because they don't have to.
Yeah, no, that's that, and that's the answer to your question, right?
Yeah.
Is the fact that, like, because you don't have to, it's a hell of a thing. Like, the password that it comes with is going to be a mix of letters and numbers, uppercase, lowercase, all that nonsense. So, like, so in a lot of ways, it's probably the safest password that's ever going to be on the damn thing, up until you go and put a new one on there, and then at that point, you're suddenly using a bunch of stuff that somebody out there is going to be able to guess about you, right? So, like, that's just it, is like, we've got a bunch of like fun cutesy stuff in the house that like all the Wi-Fi's are named, like one of them is Star Labs and then the password's like Run Barry Run, like you know, like that kind of shit is, and it's fun when like you have somebody come over the house and you get to do that, but that's just it, right? Is it became kitschy, it became hipstery to do that, and that is the only reason it ever caught on. If it wasn't for the fact that it was like a fun joke when everybody was coming over to the house for Halloween one year, I probably wouldn't have ever bothered to change it. It's just that it was literally a goof, right? Like, like that is the only reason that I ever did like set it up that way.
I mean, I set it up the way I set it up so that my parents could find it and then not have to type in a crazy password to access it.
Oh, see, yeah, but my parents were the type that were like, don't change it because nobody's ever going to guess this one. And then they weren't wrong. They were just too paranoid to like ever make it something that somebody might be able to guess. Oh, yeah. Man.
I know,
they probably still do that.
Yeah. I mean, for a long time, it's because they all got their devices and they're like, I can't find the Wi-Fi. And I'm like, well, it's this. And they're like, well, that's too hard. And I'm like, all right, I'll fix it then. That's not a problem. And now, like, I've upgraded that modem, like, 2 times. I mean, since we've been doing this show, I've upgraded that modem 2 times. So that I have better protection on it and can still have an easy-to-find, like, network for everybody. And I have, like, ghost network set up on it. So, like, it's there. But, yeah, those people, they're probably not the people who go in and change that name. Because, like, the other thing is, when you go to access, at, like, any admin site for a modem, every router goes fucking crazy. Like, you don't want to do this. What the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah, it tries to stop you so hard. I remember when I first got the PS4 and there was the NAT type issue. Mm-hmm. Like, the PS4 just wouldn't work on NAT type 1. You had to, like, route it through NAT type 2. And, like, people had to, like, share on Reddit forums, like, how to go in and change that. And they had to be like, now, look. The router's going to tell you to not do this every step of the way, and you just have to tell it to shut the fuck up that you are the master in this house. It was just like, oh, I don't know if what I'm doing is illegal. You know, it totally is. Like,
yeah, you own it. I mean, there's plenty of things that are illegal on the internet.
Yeah.
But that one, that's just because it's like you are dampening your security right now. Based on what we believe secure is. And that's other thing, is that that's the modem company or your your internet service provider, ISP. I was going to say IPS, and that's nothing. I mean, I think it might be a type of monitor panel, but I'm not going to talk about that. I already did. Fuck me. Anywho, it's like that's their standards of security. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's the top and the most recent standard of security as well. So it's just like, it's a strange thing when like the
for the Netgear upstairs, in order to get into the account, in order to change any information about it, the literal username and password are admin and password. Like, admin is the username, password is the password. Like, yeah, at some point even they gave up on the idea that this is the most secure thing. Just sign out and change it yourself.
Sign on and change it. That's the recommendation.
Yeah.
And it, also, you know what it does? It keeps it from being kitschy for people, because the kitsch is, what's the password for the Wi-Fi? Password.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, man. Just, but yeah, and also quick shout out to the Google Nest, because of the Nest system, which stayed up and running the whole time, everything stayed connected. So I didn't have to go around the house and change everything. Literally just had to fix the Netgear. And then the Google Nest system itself just reset. Like, the second it picked up on the new thing, it was just like, oh, that boom. And just everything instantly worked. So like I, as a kid that was consistently in my house growing up, the guy that had to take care of the router in my house, we had a little Linksys system that was set up behind the computer. And, oh, man, I remember I told my parents, I'm like, look, I'm going to do this after you go to bed because it's going to take me a long time. I'm going to have to unplug, replug things in. You're going to be asking me what I'm doing. You're going to think I'm doing things wrong the entire time. I can't put up with this. I'm going to call them after you guys go to bed. And so I would stay up until like 11, 12 at night. And then as soon as they went to bed, I'd be getting on the phone with somebody at Linksys to like fix things. And it would take me 45 minutes to an hour for like things to reconnect, for me to get on with somebody for things. And so having to do that so many times growing up, not having to do that yesterday was marvelous. Like, the fact that I changed one password and then like everything kicked in and I was just like back on my Netflix, back on downloading stuff on my PlayStation. Like, thank you for that.
Cool. Very cool. For me, I had a friend that I haven't spoken to in 10 years, probably not a friend anymore, who set up our network the first time that we did it. And I'm talking like this was sophomore year of high school. So do the math if you know me. You don't have to otherwise. And he made it look so hard. And then I realized that the reason that he did that was so that we would be beholden to him fixing it in the future.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say 10 years doesn't matter. A friend is a friend is a friend. That's the kind of shit that makes you not a friend anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it all sort of boiled over. And when I'm like, hey, you know what? I don't need you in my life anymore. 2011, Devin Decker out, dropping both mics. It's the situation there.
Right. That's the kind of shit I'm talking about, man. Like as a kid, they went through dorms in college and apartments where I lived with people where they were in charge of the internet. And like, they were happy to do all of the paperwork and all of the bullshit, but they also were the keeper of the keys. Anytime somebody came over and I was like, hey, my friend needs to get their get the password for the Wi-Fi, and like, you change it once a month, I don't know why, can you tell them what it is right now? And they're just like, I don't know, how often is he going to be over here, what kind of stuff are you guys going to be doing? I'm like, you're not my mom. like we want to get on the internet, shut up. Oh, man. Yeah.
It's just a thing. I don't like this. So I really like that I'm no longer beholden to it, especially like during the pandemic, right, where the internet became very important. And I'm like, you know what? I want to wire up everything. And I had a thought on how to wire up everything in my house. And my computer friends, the same people who built PCs, who like, now I guess I'm learning, don't really know everything just because they can build a computer. Right? They got YouTube videos for that, apparently.
Yeah, man. Anybody in IT that thinks that they know everything about IT is the biggest idiot in the room. The first thing you learn when you enter this field is, oh, I know nothing, and Google is my friend.
Yeah, right? Let me Google that for you, is a beautiful mantra. And so I just dove in with what my plan was, and it works so well. Like, the fact that every connection that I have wired is reaching the exact limit I pay for on up and download, and sometimes exceeding it, that blows my mind. And honestly, to do that, it cost me less than what either of the modems I bought cost alone.
Yeah.
Like, so it makes me happy to know that, like, really, you just need to not be afraid to mess up. You just need to, like, experiment, and if it works, it works, and if it doesn't, Amazon's got a pretty good return policy.
Yeah, man. Yeah, no, so it's been a wild week as far as the internet stuff goes. Like, listening, like, realizing how little we actually all really know and understand about things, it has been really eye-opening. You know, I don't mean that the people that were out there talking about how it was the end of the world when Facebook was down, like, not because, no, we can't talk to each other, but specifically stating what is happening to Facebook right now is like the nightmare scenario, because if it can happen to Facebook, it can happen to anybody. And this shit is scary. Like, the website is just gone. Things have just disappeared. They essentially like had to rebuild the roadmap for the entirety of Facebook in order to get it back online. That's some scary shit, right?
I mean, the scariest thing is that the door to the server room was locked because of the servers that they were trying to get in to fix.
Yeah.
Because those servers didn't know how to unlock that door. There was like no way to get in there and fix it.
Like, right?
That opened my eyes up to, yeah, it would be really cool if I just had an electric lock on my door and I could unlock it like a car. I would love that. But then also, you got to change the batteries, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to be locked out of my house because I forgot to change the batteries. Yeah, God forbid. Also, like, oh, we updated your door lock and now your remote, and it has a different frequency and you're going to have to get that updated. And if I don't find out about that, I can't get into my house or out of my house. Like, what?
Yeah. Yeah. But even those people that were like talking about that and trying to explain to people what's kind of going on right now, why you should be worried, why you should be concerned, even they weren't getting everything right. Right. And like, in that, like, the knowledge that even the people telling us, like, here's what the issue is, here's how to resolve it, here's what it's going to look like, even they weren't right, right? And, like, that's scary. Look at the COVID response. But, like, the idea being that even the people in charge don't know what they did, like, all of the things that we thought they did, like, just that realization over the last, like, 7 days has just been earth-shattering for me in a lot of ways.
Yeah. That Twitch leak was kind of earth-shattering for me, but just because I didn't realize that some of these people on Twitch were like multi-millionaires.
Well, you got to remember
that half of it goes to Twitch, but
it's not just that. It's not just halved, right? Depending on how the person's business is set up,
yeah,
there's a lot of things that are going into overhead costs and stuff like that. The other thing is that Twitch came really into popularity, and this is, I think, one of the big ones that nobody's really like thinking about or talking about, but Twitch really kind of came into popularity during the era of online personalities that's often referred to as the, I'm trying to think, MatPat actually is the guy that named this, and so I want to make sure I use the right term here. It's a spoke and wheel or hub and spoke. That's what it is. the hub and spoke model of online business, where specifically online personality business, where there's one person that is kind of like the it, right? Like they are the ones that everybody is really paying attention to, but they have a group of friends around them that they like playing games with. It's guaranteed groups for that sort of stuff, and they'll pump them. They'll go onto Twitch one night specifically to play this person or play that person. You see it a lot in Twitch streamers when they're signing off and they say, hey, I'm signing off, but we should all do a Twitch raid, or we should all do a hype train on like this user or that user before I go. So like they'll bounce over to a channel, they'll go with their fans, like I don't know why I did this analogy, but like Andy Kaufman leading his crowd to cookies and milk. like they will go to this channel and they'll raid them with a bunch of new people to watch, and then they'll bounce out, meanwhile leaving a good third of their audience behind on this other person that they're supporting, right? And what a lot of people don't know is that that person probably quote-unquote works for them, right? We really see it a lot once we eventually get to the house model of Twitch, where like a bunch of people move into a house together. So like you have that one person, like Pokimane or whatever, that's like the one person in the house that has all of the fans, and then Michael Reeves moves in with her so that like she can then say, hey, don't forget to go check out this YouTube channel, don't forget to go check out this Twitch stuff. Meanwhile, Reeves is also getting like, you know, 10% of what she's getting on a regular basis because he's in the business. All of the money that they all make goes into a pot, and then he gets a payout. And it's there's also something to be said about that, as a lot of people are just like, oh, this person makes $2 million. And then, as you pointed out, well, a lot of that goes to Twitch. And then the other thing to consider is some of that goes into overhead. Like they need to put money aside because if they ever need to pick up a new rig, if they ever need to pick up new sound equipment, if they ever need to move house, because that happens on a regular basis. These guys are constantly moving to new areas because a lot of them also play the real estate game. But then on top of that, like they then pay their people. And I don't just mean like their editors and stuff, which is hugely important more on YouTube than Twitch, but there's a lot of people out there that will pay their admins on Twitch to like make sure that like, hey, the game name is right at the bottom of my screen, or hey, my like system is not working, I'm not getting emojis on screen like I used to. They pay somebody to take care of that shit. And then they also are paying all of their friends that are playing with them on a regular basis. And like, that sounds gross to put it that way, but it's the thing that keeps these people free to do the kind of things that we love to watch them do. So like in a lot of ways, it's the same way we don't think about like actors getting paid, are actually paying a whole entourage of people behind them to make sure that their life is running well so that they have time to still be the actor that we like. And we think it's weird because they're like paying their brother to just hang out with them all day, but that's not all that guy's doing, right? Like that guy going to get dinner for him on Friday means that he got to stay on set for an extra few hours in order to do the scene that he wanted to do, right? Like that it's a really weird system of business that we don't quite all know or understand, and because of that, those numbers look horrendous.
Yeah, I don't know. It just, I would have never thought that. Like, you think full-time Twitch streamer, right? As that, mm-hmm. as a job. And then I'm doing the math on, like, the top 100 were out there and easily visible to see for right. everybody, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the amount they make in a month is what most people make as a yearly salary. And yeah. I just had never considered that. That, like, I know that there's money in it, but I didn't realize just how much money is in it.
Oh, for sure. And, like, to put out an exception to the rule, the reason why people like PewDiePie, Felix, whatever his last name is, he's
I don't know, we don't need to give him anything. He's an asshole anyway, so.
But the reason that he is who he is because he specifically doesn't have any of this. He is a guy that figured all of this stuff out. He was in when this shit was new, so he didn't have the systems in place to go into this sort of stuff. And so the money that he makes and the reason that people talk about him, even though some of the numbers we saw were actually bigger than some of the numbers we've seen with him pulling in some years, the reason why it's so important is because he keeps all of his money. Right. There is not any other business. So the reason that while one person might make $4 million in a year when he only makes 3.7, but we focus on him and not the $4 million, is because that $4 million gets spread out in a way where that streamer ends up maybe only seeing like $1.3 million. Boo-hoo. Meanwhile, he gets to keep his 3.7, and like that's his life. And so that is what makes guys like him stick out. Or to another personality like that kid, Ryan, the Ryan's World kid that like, yeah. makes all that money. The reason why it's such a big deal is because that money is only going to just him and his parents. Like there may be a small business around him now because he's doing things like video games and stuff like that. But for years, that was not the case. That was pure profit for them. So yeah. like that's why those personalities rise to the top, despite the fact that we now know that so many other people are kind of in that same echelon, is because everybody else is not being an asshole about it.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And the other thing to think of on that is that listing was specifically just Twitch payouts. And these people, some of them take donations directly to them on like PayPal,
Patreon,
and things like that, and Patreon, and mm-hmm. all of these other ways that they can do it. So if the numbers on the Twitch side of what people are making was like enough to make you blush, know that there's probably more.
Well, and if there's somebody that's making that much money on Twitch, they are also putting an editing team in place to yeah. take their Twitch videos. So they're double dipping on their work, which more power to them. I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but they will pay an editor to then take their 3-hour Twitch stream, edit it down to 45 minutes and throw it on YouTube later that night. And then suddenly they're getting monetized on YouTube for an almost hour long video with a bunch of commercials and shit in it that they then also see a bunch of money about. So like the money that they're making on Twitch is literally becomes a fraction of whatever else they may be making. One or two of those people on that list have OnlyFans, and I'm not like that's, you know, that's your business. Like you start mm-hmm. on Twitch, you tell them like you really want to check out the cool content, like you check out my OnlyFans, and we all know that that is a whole other like venue of just like mystery and mystique, right? Like there's just
erotic
there's
mystery
so much going on
of OnlyFans.
So you're not wrong. Like the numbers that we saw there were gross, and the ways in which that money is not fully understood is gross, and the fact that that money is the tip of the iceberg is perhaps the grossest part.
I mean, we say gross, but at the same time, they work for it. It's just I would have never thought it was that high.
It's gross in the same way that like watching a pro basketball player who's decided that he's not going to get his COVID shot, and we're still talking about paying him for games is gross. Like it's that idea that just like there's no level of accountability on that amount of money for these people, and that gets really scary because of the kind of weird influences that we think about that they have. And I mean, like the term influencer exists for a reason, right? Like, yeah. like that is when it starts to get really weird and gross, is that you have a person in this position and they have potential to do some real damage to society on like a social and unconscious level. But like, we also are a people that understand that you can't regulate that.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. It was surprising, but then I will say like one person that I watch semi-regularly, and even then I've moved away from it because I don't really enjoy it. He was in that top 100 and he regularly streams 16 hours a day.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, he's making that money, but 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's not nothing.
Yeah, and I don't know if he's the guy that I'm thinking about as well, but I know somebody that was in that has that same time that I think is the guy we're talking about, that also a lot of the work that he's doing is charity work.
No, I think we're talking about different people. Like, okay. That was specifically why it struck me, is that, like, this guy is just playing games. Just,
like, we don't want to name names.
Yeah, I don't want to be like, well, because like, you're kind of blowing people up somebody's spot, right? Like, it's a weird thing, like, we all looked at it, right? And I think everybody who looked at it, I don't know, like for me, it was morbid curiosity in terms of like, how much are these people making? Is it any of the people that I watch? Oh, okay. There's a name that I know. Oh, wow. And I think maybe there was another name that I knew, but like the names that I recognized were people that like are known, like they've been on the Stephen Colbert show as speedrunners. They've been in other forms of media for like being good at video games, so like it almost makes sense that they would have that name brand recognition on Twitch.
Yeah, and the other side of this conversation that we haven't even touched on is the idea that this is also the majority of it money coming from people that willingly give it to them. Yeah. And I'm not saying that there's not some element of playing on people's emotions and maybe not being entirely clear, but like there have been straight up YouTubers that have been called out for the act of getting on YouTube and acting like, oh, I don't even have enough money for food this week. You know, this is the way that my life is, though, because I want to make sure I give all this content to my fans. And then lo and behold, they're making hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars a year. This is the persona that they put on because they know it gets them more dosh, right? And that is the extreme. the idea that these guys get on and somebody gives them money and we thought that they were so poor that they needed your $5 donation, that's ridiculous. Nobody out there thinks that they're saving their favorite Twitch streamer's life by dropping some bits on them, right? Like, that's just not – nobody's under that illusion.
I mean, you say that, but there are people who probably are. I mean, like, that's the other thing, is that it really does speak to the same type of people who would be enticed by something like loot boxes and things like that. They're the same type of people who could be susceptible to an influencer on YouTube or Twitch saying, I need this money. Like,
yeah. Well, let me correct that statement then. Because that's exactly my point. If the Twitch streamer is saying that, that's on them. That's stupid. But if your favorite Twitch streamer is not, if that's not their act that they're putting on, if they're just playing games and you just happen to drop money on them, and then you found out that they're a millionaire and you were just like, well, I gave them $5 thinking they needed the money. If they didn't come to you, like, not every one of those people on that list is out there begging. I would say the majority of the people on that list, they didn't ask to become millionaires doing what they do. They just were business savvy. And yes, they went out and they said, like, I want to get paid to do this, and they got paid to do this. But I don't think anybody out there on that list, I don't think that there's a significant portion of people on that list claiming that they were making no money and now suddenly we learn that they did, for anyone to be like aghast at the fact that there were people on that list making that much money. I just don't believe it. In fact, a large number of those guys, especially towards the top, have openly talked about the fact that they like one of the things that they really appreciate about their fans is the ability that they've been given to make this amount of money with their fan base. Like, there are some people on there that have just been completely open about the fact that they're just like, look, I lead a good life, and I wouldn't lead a good life if it wasn't for the fact that your donations come in. So, like, I'm not saying stop donating. I'm just saying, like, guys, I've made it. And, like, I've heard those conversations from Twitch streamers. And so to say that, like, I'm offended that Twitch streamers are making that much, we knew they were. We've always known, and we still decided to give a little bit of money here or there, because that's what you do when you like a thing. You want to make sure it keeps going, so you provide for it.
Right. I mean, there's an inherent value, and they call it tipping or they call it subscribing, and you do that in order to support the content that you want to keep seeing.
Exactly.
And again, it's not that I was aghast. I want to make sure that nobody thinks that, like, oh my God, it's just, I would have never thought that, like, those were the things. And granted, some of that is some of the people that I watch or I'll like dip into have things like bills for October and how much is paid and how much they need.
Yeah.
And like that type of stuff. And I'm like, that feels a little weird what you're doing there. But then also that there's coercion. It might not be like a nefarious type of coercion, but it's the type of thing that could coerce a viewer to continue donating, hearing from somebody, because of donations from viewers like you, I'm able to live a life of ease, of a life of comfort. So thanks, fam. I appreciate your tips. And more
often than not, it comes in the form of, I can keep doing this because of the life that you've allowed me to lead.
Right.
The fact that I can sit here for 16 hours a day and play this video game is because I don't have to leave my house and make this fortune that I've made. Like, that's usually the way that gets packaged.
Right.
And it's a fair thing to say. Like, I don't know. It's really I think the thing that's really striking me all weird about the whole thing is that it's not so much people being surprised about the amount of money. It's not so much people being like, oh, I thought this person was in this position, but they're actually in that position. It's the idea that there's been this weird feeling amongst the crowd that we need some what's the word I'm looking for? Not clarity, but like some visibility on like what is going on with these streamers. And the fact that we are doing this.
So transparency.
Transparency. Thank you. The fact that there's such a call for transparency here on a bunch of people on Twitch, when there's so many other places in this world where transparency.
We're transparent. Yeah. Like, it honestly feels like, in a way, the corporations, again, pitting us against each other. Right?
Yeah, let's,
because yeah, it is a like, pittance. Yeah, like, even though, like, the top guy on that list, I think over the last 2 years, because it was only 2 years of earnings that were released for each person, I think it was maybe like $1.5 million in that time, if memory serves correctly. But again, it's good that I'm being vague because I don't want to blow up anybody's spot. I'll be honest about that, right? That $1.5 million is nothing compared to the trillions of dollars that other things that we've mentioned in this episode, Google and Amazon, are collecting every day.
Yeah.
Right? And I mean, and then there's the other, you know, baby with the bathwater is the fact that Twitch is a subsidiary and is owned by Amazon. So mm-hmm. all of that money, that part that's not going to the content creators, right, is going into the pockets of Daddy Bezos. And I know that he's not in charge anymore, and he's never been in charge of the Twitch side. They have their own CEO, own COO, but they report all their money. They're a subsidiary of Amazon, right? So that's an important thing to say, because a lot of people were saying, oh, Daddy Bezos. And then, like, the first thing was, well, he stepped back from working at Amazon. Yeah, but even if he hadn't stepped back from working with Amazon to be an astronaut, that doesn't change the fact that Twitch is its own, like, entity and has its own board and people who run it.
Yeah, I think the call for transparency when donations involved is a completely fair and rational one. I just wish that other places where donations were involved, this kind of tenacity existed, right? Like, you hear about it sometimes, not enough as far as I'm concerned, in politics, but also, like, you know, charitable organizations. Like, the fact that, like, we now know that, like, there are have been cancer organizations where the only 2% of the money collected actually went to cancer research and the rest went to people working there. And, like, and for all I know, that is actual legitimate overhead that is a justifiable thing. I don't know. There's not enough transparency for me to compare it to anyone else to know if that's actually bad or not, right?
Right.
But, like,
it sounds bad, though. It sounds incendiary when you hear that this cancer organization that regularly collects billions in charitable donations, only 2% of that is actually going towards what that organization says they're helping fight. Yeah. Like, that. Yeah, I mean, and 2% of, let's say, $1 billion, that's still a significant amount of money, but it doesn't change the fact that you hear that, and without the transparency, without them coming forward and saying, well, here's our marketing budget so that you can know about us. Here's what we pay those people who are out there collecting donations. Like,
it's weird, though, when you start talking about streamers, though, right? This is where, like, you could kind of put a kink in even that system. Is, like, with Twitch, we're talking about people, right?
Yeah.
Like, are they businesses? And should they be transparent? Because they're asking for this money, but at the same time, they're just a human being, and do we deserve that, right? Is this a moment where gamers are asking too much of the people that like make their content, which is a consistent issue that we talk about on this show? but at what point is somebody, I guess, required, although that feels even worse, right? But at what point are you supposed to be transparent about the ways in which you take in cash if this is your life, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're all 1099 employees. I think that's the way that it works, right? Because Twitch is like their business overlord, but then they work for themselves.
They're contracted by Twitch, right? Yeah.
So, but then the first thing that you hear from most of it, for anybody who like is going to be creating content, the first recommendation is that you establish an LLC for yourself, limited liability corporation, so that if anything were to happen, your assets are secure and are safe.
Right. They go after your company, not after you.
Yeah.
I mean, this is when you start to get into some of the really gross stuff that's happened over the last 20 years involving things like the housing market and things like that, where people will decide they want to start flipping houses for a living. So they go into an area, buy up a bunch of property, and then like they flip it and then gentrify the hell out of an area to the point where like nobody can live there anymore. Right. And then like then their business goes under because nobody can afford their housing. But it's okay because it's all on the LLC. It's not on them. So they walk away with a golden parachute. And like meanwhile, neighborhoods now go to shit with nobody living them in the middle of the desert. Like, right? So like just to kind of give an actual visual kind of, like, of what is happening a lot of the times and what people are worried about with Twitch is that idea that like we're going to give you all of this money and then one day you just stop streaming. You walk away with $2 million after 2 years and you're just like, my bitches, I got your money. You get no more content from me, which can happen. And
I mean, it has happened. Look at like Ninja going to Mixer and then him coming back. But like when he left Twitch to take an exclusivity deal with Mixer, anybody who was subbed to him thinking that they'd have that for a month or however long from that time, he wasn't streaming on Twitch anymore. So you gave him money for services that were not rendered.
Or even if you had given him money 6 months previously.
Yeah.
But the idea being you were just putting money into a thing that you were hoping was going to be there in perpetuity. And like, and you know, and again, the question becomes, whose fault is that? Is it you as the viewer just assuming that this human was just going to dance for you because you gave them a few bits? Or is it on them for collecting that amount of money from that many people? And is it do they have a responsibility to dance at that point?
Yeah, at what point is the producer still responsible for the show, right? For paying back the investors. It's interesting, and I mean that I think that's actually part of the problem, right? Anonymous came out and it makes no sense and it's probably not true, saying that what they did with Twitch was to try to show Twitch this is what it feels like to be persecuted, which is happening whenever hate raids are happening to channels. Please try to be better, right? That it was in some way this leak, you know, doxing thousands, tens of thousands of people, right? I mean, like, that was supposed to teach Twitch a lesson?
The narrative being we doxed Twitch.
Yeah.
We didn't. But yeah. But that's the narrative.
Yeah.
Is their whole thing was we doxed Twitch so that you know what it's like when somebody gets doxed. You need to do something about this.
Right.
And it's just like, no, you didn't dox Twitch, guys. You kind of doxed everybody else.
Yeah, you kind of doxed everybody who is an independent contractor for Twitch. And honestly, has very little say in what they do, right?
And
like, they might have
victims that you're talking about.
Yes. So, weird. Kind of a weird thing. But if that were the case, right? If they were trying to send some grand message to Twitch, the information that they released really makes sense on the heels of what happened with Facebook, because it shows, look at what happened to Facebook when this information was available. We have that information already.
Yeah.
We could do the same thing to your business, straighten up and fly right. And weirdly, right, if you want to pop on the tinfoil hat and get all conspiracy theory about it, that's the type of distraction that allows Facebook to move past what happened on Monday, right?
Mm-hmm.
First of all, what happened to Facebook on Monday is distraction from the 60 Minutes interview that occurred on Sunday night, talking about Facebook basically being a cesspool of misinformation.
Boom, and there's your third act twist. Take that, Duplass Brothers. We're running the show now. But yeah, on this documentary, we've got the business. Yeah, like that's the thing that nobody has talked about, right?
Yeah.
Like, even us here until this moment didn't even mention.
Well, because it's not like, I'm not watching 60 Minutes, right? I don't need that to help me unwind. Sorry, Elaine. I don't like the stopwatch noise. The tick, 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 tick is very unnerving for me. But yeah. I'm not regularly watching 60 Minutes. So like that was something I read about and I heard about and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And then the Facebook thing, I'm like, well, that's really interesting that in the wake of a whistleblower for Facebook, Facebook went offline, and that kind of feels like Facebook did it in order to clean up their image. And to make that person look like a crazy person.
It's almost like a company that's entire business model has been based on manipulating the masses to their every whim, knows how to manipulate the masses to their every whim so they could protect themselves in this situation. Like, the reason that this works as a conspiracy theory so well is because that is right in line with everything else we know that they have done. There have been award-winning documentaries showing how they had their hand in political pies, and they were able to sway things like the entire Cambridge Analytica issue. Like, basically, we know how they do this, and they still get to do it. So, like, yes, we are in tinfoil hat times. I know that you put yours on. Mine's been on for a while. So, like, I'm not saying that there's any way that this is ever going to be able to be proved or talked about or any of that. But to think that there is not some plausibility in the idea that Facebook knows that the only way to snuff out one fire is to light a bigger one, it's like... Like, they play that game all the time. So, yeah, this seems like a plausible explanation because this is literally their playbook. This is what they do.
Yeah. And then the Twitch thing comes along, and that, and granted, it's because on Twitter, I'm in more of a gaming space Twitter, if I'm in anything, right? Mm-hmm. I've recently realized that as everybody talked about Metroid Dread, which is something that we were going to talk about on this episode, but this has been far more interesting. And I promise we'll still talk about Metroid Dread because I got thoughts and I got feelings and I want to share them. But like, people are still talking about the Twitch leak, and it's not just us a week later, because this is our first time to interface about it. There are people who are on Twitch using the revealed information to try to get more subs and money to them, right? I'm number 1493. Let's try to get me up to 13. And it's like,
that is the most dystopian, like, awesome cyberpunk way to go with this.
I know. It would just,
you had a huge cyber leak. All my information is on the internet. You saw how poor I am. Let's make me richer.
Yeah. It, like, on the one hand, I'm like, good for you, like, owning it. On the other hand, wow, that's where the cynicism bar is set for the country right now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, I watched it because of that number. I'm like, let's see if this guy's worth it. I didn't end up subscribing or tipping, right? I rarely do anyway. As a Twitch Prime member, because I have Amazon Prime, I'll give my Twitch Prime subscription out. But, ironically enough, I was afraid about putting any sort of monetary information into Twitch because it didn't seem like a very secure website.
Yeah. Yeah, I that is something everybody is going to have to come to terms with, is like, my information is out there in some way or another. And yes, we should be updating passwords monthly. Yes, we should be making sure that we're staying on top of checking our credit card statements as much as possible. All of that stuff that we should be doing, and none of us do, right? Like, there's just... There is something here about the apathy of internet security that we really need to address. And that is just one piece of just everything that's gone on over the last 2 years, of the ways in which we've become so dependent on all of these systems. You know, whether it's Twitch and Facebook to keep us occupied when we're not at work, or when we are at work, staying on the goddamn internet. Like the ways in which we've become so dependent on this thing, and we all told ourselves we were gonna get smarter about, because it became such an important part of our life. And all this week did is just show me that we were just all full of shit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and again, it's because the people in power, they're more interested. Well, let's talk about Texas and the abortion bill, and how that's pretty much like the headline everywhere, to the fact that the federal courts overturned an appeal to it over this past weekend, which is just kind of terrifying. I only know that because I went to the dentist this morning and that's what was on. And that was an uncomfortable waiting room for the dentist, because like, some people were like real happy that happened, and I'm like, oh, okay, cool, so I can just read this room, right? I feel like I'm alone, because that's crazy that the federal court, who, like, Roe versus Wade is a thing, right? And that's the federal mandate. And then that a federal appeal would be like, nah, that bill in Texas, right? States' rights. Go for it.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, like, those are the things that are...
There are a lot of arguments to be made that at the federal level, certain decisions are made specifically so things can get in front of the Supreme Court eventually. Mm-hmm. I don't know, man. I'm not defending that decision at all. It's just the idea that, like, one could easily look at that as a play to make sure it gets punted down the road to a larger thing.
But right now, but look at that larger thing. Well, right. I don't know if it survives.
Yep.
If we're being honest. I mean, getting a little more political on the show than we usually do, but it isn't everything. But those are the matters that slid into the forefront, right? Like the rigging of the election, which we're still talking about, right? There are still people who say that Trump had the election stolen from him. And Joe Biden's almost been in office for an entire year from the last election, from the election in 2020.
What's the scoreboard now? 7 different attacks on it, and all of them knocked down? Every single one of those pins knocked down? Including one in Arizona where they found more votes for Biden.
The independent inquiry into the election revealed that we actually missed some votes for the guy who won. Our bad, right? Oh, well. But then also, like, all this talk, like, my parents were out of the state. They were traveling over the weekend, and they heard people talking about how they're ready for the next civil war. And like, that's just a discussion that is happening right now in our country. And I'm like, well, that's crazy, until I see next Civil War trending on Twitter.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. It's just like, it's first of all, it's not surprising because of the nature of humanity and the fact that even though we say we're going to make a change or fix something, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen. Right.
Yeah.
So us saying we're going to take a focus on internet security, and by all accounts, we really should have, considering how much the internet has become an actual factual utility because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And right. We just haven't, like, that makes sense. There's also the fact that the distractions in this country have never let up from when we said we need to address this issue, to a point that, like, anything could get done on that issue. I don't know.
Yeah, we're just screaming into a void that Joe Rogan's been the master of for the last 7 years, man. I don't know if we're going to
Yeah, right, that's true. I guess, I don't know. I don't listen to the Joe Rogan podcast. Joe Rogan is going to always be that character on news radio and nothing more. Though, I mean, he's kind of playing that character from news radio now with the way he approaches the world, I guess, based on the little bits I see on Twitter every now and then.
Oh, man.
I don't know. I just don't know. And it's really not something we're going to solve. It's just one of those situations where, like, oh, yeah, of course the internet hasn't been touched, because even a week later, we're not thinking about the internet, even though it affected so many people. And granted, part of that is also because if you want a company to convince people everything is fine and this misinformation is the way, Facebook's the one you want. So if they're going to be the ones affected, they're going to be the first ones to convince your crazy aunts and uncles. No, 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 no. We just kicked a power outlet out of the wall and then Lou had to plug it back in.
And everything was fine. Everything was fine.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Who, Dev?
Yeah.
Let's do some toy time.
Let's do some toy time. Yeah. I believe you have a toy that you want to talk about.
Oh, I thought you might want to talk about the your toy first that you hinted at earlier, but we could definitely...
Oh, what? Metroid Dread? That's not a toy. That's a video game. Video games and toys are different things.
I don't know, Dev. I don't watch a lot of that there Twitch that you all do. I don't I'm not a Twitcher. Okay.
No, so, I think we need a break from video game talk. We just talked about Twitch and all of that, which is pretty much in the video game space for a good hour. Let's take a break before we discuss Metroid Dread.
Let's take 20 minutes to talk about possibly the greatest figure that I own in this house and will cherish to the end of my days, because there is it is October, and I feel really weird talking about my birthday. Do you ever feel that way? Like, I feel like really weird, like, reminding people or like telling people that it's my birthday. Like, I feel like it's not my responsibility to do.
Well, yeah, like, I feel like another friendship that ended was because somebody was like, "So what do you want to do for your birthday? The usual?" And I'm like, "No, I'd like to do something fun and different." And they're like, "Well, you plan it." And I'm like, "Oh, I guess I've gotten to that point in my life." And their response was, "You don't need to be a dick about it." And I'm like, "I don't think I'm being a dick for like you thought enough to think about my birthday, and you're like, how are we going to celebrate your birthday? Think up something fun for me to be a part of." Like, no, it's supposed to be the other way.
Like, there does hit a point, I think, in every person's life where they kind of have to take up the reins for a little bit, right?
Yeah.
At some point, you end up with, like, family and friends around you that you do know well enough that you don't have to do that anymore. But there is a weird period in everyone's life where you've got a couple in your way that you just got to decide what you want to do about it. Mm-hmm. And it sneaks up on you, because at first, it's, like, it's freeing. There's like that one or two birthdays you first get, like, in your, I would say like 23 or 24 is like the usual time that this happens, because 21, everybody's super happy. They plan your birthday. And then 22, everybody remembers the 21st. They're like, "Oh, we got to do something. It's his birthday again." And I mean, it's going to be smaller, but they at least remember to do something about it. 23 is when people start to be just like, "Oh, we just did a thing last year." Like,
yeah.
Right. So you take it upon yourself. And as I said, like, at that point in your life, like, you no longer have family planning it for you. In college, you probably had a bunch of drunk roommates that you didn't really like hanging out with, but they were like, it's your birthday, we got a drink, like, so they plan it for you. And so then you hit that point where you get to do something you want to do. So you go out, you have a steak and a beer that you never would have, or you go to a movie, or you know, like, you do something for yourself that, like, because nobody else has ever thought of doing it for you, partially because you probably have not been vocal enough about it, but also because, like, you know, sometimes that's just the way that things work out, is there's just this thing that, like, you've always wanted to do and it's just never quite worked, like go to Disney or something. But then later in your life, you do have those people that have been around you long enough to get the point again. You just got to build that repertoire back up, right? Like, right. And so yeah, I am kind of in that weird mid phase where, like, I have people around me that are like, hey, your birthday's soon, I would like to do something with you, but you never talked to me about what you want to do. And, like, it's just like, I get it. So, like, you know, I'm kind of going through that phase, right? So it is the perfect time in my life for me to be receiving surprise gifts, because it's been such a long time since I've gotten something, like, unexpectedly, but this was extremely unexpected. I got a gift completely mislabeled for me the other day, by the way. Thank you.
Well, I mean, hopefully once you opened it, you understood the mislabeling.
Oh, no, I understood. Yeah. So I go ahead and I open it up. And it is this phenomenal action figure of Hush from, I believe, the 7th issue in the series. I'm not going to try and get too nerdy on it here yet, because we're about to get super nerdy about it in a second. But I open it up, gorgeous looking figure. I'm looking at all these details. And the thing is I'm just like, this is amazing, because this is a literal one-off moment in a comic that never gets addressed again. And in fact, gets overshadowed a lot of the time because of something that ends up happening a little bit later in the history of the comics. There's this huge thing that happens, and I'm just like, this is awesome, this is great. And I start looking at the box, and half of it is written in, I'm gonna guess, Chinese. You would know more than I at this point.
I believe it's a Japanese company.
Japanese.
Yeah.
So I'm reading this, and all I'm getting out of it is, this is Hush, finally here. Hush, Batman Hush, from this comic, Hush. And then it says Thomas Elliot, and I was just like, yeah, except nah. And so I'm like reading into it more, and I start like researching it, and I have literally spent the last 24 hours with what little internet that I had, like, trying to figure out if there's something I misremembered, if there's something about this particular toy, if anybody else has pointed out this issue. The only thing that I could find that kind of went hand in hand with what I thought is one article from GameSpot buried in this, like, praise of this figure, is this one moment where it says labeled Thomas Elliot, but we all know otherwise, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, wait, okay. So you're hinting at knowing what the problem is here, but nobody's going to address this. The problem is that the figure is beautiful and phenomenal, and it's not Thomas Elliot. So let's get into some spoilers for the Hush storyline. Like, so Hush is this phenomenal character where there's like a year-long story written by Jim Lee, I believe, and all the and that crew, where it is revealed that there is a character that just hates not just Batman but also Bruce Wayne, that is, like, systematically destroying his life from both sides, right? And, like, all of the villains seem to be working for him all of a sudden. All of the people in his life suddenly start turning on him because they're being blackmailed or they've been coerced by this person, and he can't figure it out. Who is it? Who is Hush? It is a truly phenomenal Batman story because of the fact that it embraces not just, like, all of the weird villain stuff that Batman has going on, but also a phenomenal detective story. And I've probably gushed about this before, because there was a DC animated attempt at making a movie of it a few years back that, if I did talk about it, I probably talked about how I didn't like
it. Oh, it was awful. I watched it so we could discuss it. Yeah. And the and identity of Hush in that made no sense.
Yeah, it is completely changed. Because in the comics, it is part of the shtick of the story is every couple of issues, Batman thinks he's figured it out, and we think at one point that it's Two-Face. We think at one point that it's Riddler. We think at one point that it's, we think at one point there's a moment where it might be Jason Todd. For a couple of issues, Jason Todd at this point is still dead, and there's all of this evidence that suddenly starts pointing to him, things that people would know, ways into the Batcave, his blood is found somewhere along the line. Like, there's all of these little details that suddenly he's like, oh my god, Jason. And he goes to Jason's grave and digs it up, and lo and behold, it's empty. Now, anybody that knows anything about me and my love of Batman knows that one of the greatest stories in Batman for me, one of my favorite stories, is the Red Hood story, in which Jason Todd, who was killed years earlier as a Robin, comes back and reveals that he is turned on Batman because he feels Batman's responsible for his death, right? This is about 2 years before that happens, just to give people some context. That has not yet happened. So the idea that Jason Todd might be back, this is like juicy, and this is huge. And then there is a moment where we see Hush revealed, and it is Jason. And he's even got Tim Drake, the new Robin, hostage. And he's, like, threatening to kill him and all of this stuff. And there's this whole conversation. And then all of a sudden, the big reveal at the end of that moment is that Batman, Bruce Wayne, reveals that he's known the whole time it could not possibly be Jason. And that it is, in fact, Clayface, pretending to be Jason Todd, under the guise that he had been helping out all of these villains using the knowledge that he has. So there's this weird, like, hole that's kind of left in the story, because somehow a lot of knowledge about Batman did get out, but this character that was Jason is not Jason. Also, Jason's body is missing. So, like, there is this weird element. Lo and behold, 2 years later, that's when we get into the whole storyline of the Red Hood and the idea that Jason was brought back to life, whether it was Ra's al Ghul or other variations on the story that have come out over time. But, like, this is the first moment where that's even possibly hinted at. The idea that Jason may not actually be dead after him being dead for, at this point, almost a decade, over a decade. Like, it's humongous. It's a huge moment. And so this toy is this beautiful recreation of that. It is Hush, but then revealed to be Jason. And that's amazing, but then revealed to be Clayface. It's like it's a reveal upon a reveal. And that is in no way acknowledged by this toy. And in fact, quite the opposite. This toy line, this Batman Hush toy line that they've been releasing characters out of over the last year, from what I can tell, this was their moment to finally do Hush. They've done Batman, they've done Catwoman, I think they did, like, the Riddler or Joker or something like that, but this was like, finally, we're gonna finally put Hush out. And they did, but then they didn't. And all of the, like, all of the advertising and, like, all of the eBay listings and everything are like, finally, Hush released, and it's not Hush. And everything's like, Thomas Elliott, the character you've been waiting for on your shelves, finally, and it's not him.
Yeah, I know. I saw it and I said, Seijin needs to have this. Seijin would never purchase this for himself. Seijin's birthday is coming up. I'm going to order it knowing that it will get to him in October. I knew that it would get you in October. I was hoping a little bit closer to your actual birthday.
Yeah.
But then I got the thing that it shipped and I'm like, oh, he's going to get that early. That's okay. Fine.
It's amazing.
You're not going to expect a birthday gift weeks before your birthday.
I'll be honest. My mom sent me a package not 2 or 3 days ago, and I thought, oh, maybe this is the birthday. You know, she sends like a box of, like, funny enough, she sends like a bag of Reese's Cups, and it is the best tasting Reese's Cups I get all year. I don't know why, but they always taste better for mom. But, like, that's what she sent.
Because Will Arnett, like, didn't get his dirty fingers on him. She went right to the source.
So
I love,
like,
you, Will Arnett.
Like,
I'm just saying.
Like, rubbing my mom sends me this box of, like, rubbing my hands. I'm like, I'm all excited. I'm just like, yes, go get me them good Reese's Cups, finally. I open it up, and it's a bunch of old report cards she found. Half of them are Zach's. I don't know why she felt the need to send them to me. She was like, I found these. I thought you might want them. But I was like, why would I want Zach's old report cards? And she was like, oh, send those back. I was like, God damn it. But anyway, then this box came, and it was a much better present. So to remove, like, the nerdy Seijin gushing about the great gift Devin bought him thing, right? Like, step away from that, because that's a you and me thing. Let's talk about an everybody thing.
Yeah.
The fact that, like, this company, like, played on this idea that they were going to wait, like, 3, 4, 5, 6 toys into the release of this line to finally release Hush. And then the Hush that they put out is this weird one-off moment that is not him, is fucking wild to me. Like, it made me really, I've never been huge into the collector's world, and I know you've more than dipped your toe into it, and we've talked about it a lot, but like, it really kind of gave me like some major insight into the ways in which some of these companies that are involved in this stuff, and we've talked about how this can get really problematic with the ways in which they play on like collecting fever, like that they don't even know what they're doing. Like, it's not unusual to hear about weird mistakes made and things like that, but like, they are literally selling this character labeled as Thomas Elliot, and it's not.
So,
and people are excited. People are spending a lot of money. I'm not the kind of guy to sit here and ask what you spent on it, but the research that I did dictates that it was some money. And like, people out there are spending that because they're just like, I don't care, I want it, nom nom nom. And it's just like, whoa, wait a minute.
Yeah. Everybody knows I got Wolverine on the desk. Something I added to the desk last year is a favorite 90s Marvel character. To call him C-List would probably be giving him too much credit. And his name is Thunderstrike. Eric Masters is his other identity. And later on, his son, Jason Masters, takes over the identity to become Thunderstrike. And what it is that Eric, while Thor was sick, picked up Mjolnir and became Thor for him. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, when Thor got better, Thor gave him his own hammer, which is called Thunderstrike. And then someone heard him refer to his hammer as Thunderstrike, and they thought that was his superhero name. So he kind of fell into that being his identity. And it is very clearly the Eric Masters version of Thunderstrike. And all of the toy talk about it being the son of the original Thunderstrike, who wears a completely different outfit. So, like, that's oh, just a story that I could tell you about collecting-wise. Is yeah. I saw it and I'm like, holy shit, Eric Masters is getting a figure? Because he was the Thor that took part in the not the Infinity War. Yeah, the Infinity War. Like, Thor was sick during it, so the Thor in Infinity War is actually Eric Masters. And that was huge to me as a kid, right? Because the Infinity War was one of the first things that I ever read comics-related, right? And it got me into a bunch of these other obscure fucking characters who, like, really don't matter in terms of Marvel anymore. But that's a figure that means a lot to me. And on some level, it's not really Eric Masters, even though it looks like Eric Masters. So yeah, I just want to tell you that, like, you're not wrong. This is a thing that exists in the collector space.
Well, and it's not, like I said before, like, it's not weird to have, like, misprints and things like that be right. huge to collectors. I mean, there's an entire Simpsons Bartman arc about the silver-dipped Radioactive Man comics, right? Isn't that what happens
That's
in that one?
That's exactly what happens, yeah.
But like, there's this idea that if there is a mistake made, people want it because there's going to be a correction eventually. And I want to be in before that. Right. Like, I don't know why this is a really gross example, but the one that always comes to me in this moment is the Mark Jacobson or Mark Jackson card. I don't remember the basketball player, but do you know anything about the Mark Jackson, like, lore of the Topps card that he had that had to get, like, remade?
A little bit, not enough to talk about with anything, but it's, if you're going to collect things, you hear those stories.
Yeah. So the idea that in the background, literally like almost more front and center than him on the card is the Menendez brothers, like the day after they killed their parents.
Yeah.
Like the story is they killed their parents and then went to go see the Knicks play and like sat like front, like used their parents' credit card to buy like front like seat, like tickets to like watch the
floor
game.
Seats. Yeah.
Yeah. Like just crazy. Like, and then somehow, just by the luck of draw, that is the image that got chosen to go on this card. And then, like, eventually they changed. They were like, well, you can't have that. But, like, anybody that's got, like, a Mark Jackson card with the Menendez brothers on it is, like, it's, like, a huge deal, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Maybe, like, the money might be going, like, the money might not be worth much of anything because I don't think Mark Jackson was much of a player. But honestly, the card might be worth more as the rarity because of the Menendez brothers on it.
It's a Menendez right. brothers trading card.
God, exactly, right? Well, that's the thing, right? It gets really gross in that way. But so, like this kind of thing comes up, and this lore bubbles up, and those become worth more than the good thing. So, like, the good thing, the corrected thing. Like, that idea being that, like, we something about in that collector fever, like, you kind of feel that urge of, like, wanting that thing. like, and I get that as I like sit here and talk about this toy and about how much I love this idea that like it is based on literally what could not be more than like two or three pages at the end of this like middling issue on this whole story arc, because eventually we learn what's going on in the rest of the story, and it is so far removed from this that it is just, it's just a passing, like, it's a passing moment that shows just how fucked up Hush and Bruce's relationship is, or Hush and Batman's relationship is, that he was willing to go this far as to literally like dig up and hide Jason Todd's body on him is like that becomes the more important element, not the fact that you thought for two or three panels that it might have actually been Jason, until 2 years later when the Red Hood story goes, suddenly we've got that big mystery again about who is it, suddenly there's that idea like it looks like it might be Jason Todd, and there's that moment where you go, well, they tried to pull that one on us before and that didn't play out, oh shit, it's actually him. Like, it, really all that moment is literally set up for a story down the line, and now I have that toy of it. I just cannot believe that they that of the little bit that I can read on the box, it talks about it just being Thomas Elliot.
Right. And I think the reason for that, it's an interesting thing, because we also talk about marketing a lot on this. And I saw that figure, and the reason why I knew it was something that you, like, I'm like, this is something that CJ would want, is that it comes with the Robin head and the Robin emblems from that moment.
So that you can replace the ones on the figure. Yeah. It's so good. You could literally recreate that one shot.
You can recreate that one panel. And the second I saw that, I'm like, Seijin loves the Hush storyline so much, and Seijin is such a fan of Under the Red Hood, that like this is the perfect congruence of those two moments in figure form. Yeah. In this weird way that, like, I don't know why this is happening, but the fact it, when I saw that it came with the emblems, and I'm like, well, yeah, and that's how Batman knew that it was Clayface, because like Hush wouldn't have redone the emblems. That's a Clayface flourish.
Well, right, because he's literally creating, right? Yeah,
yeah. It's because that's how that's, we would, because so, you know, he's an actor, and that's the type of commitment he would do to the character. Like, it's just, it's such a stupid detail that I'm like, I need to hand it to him. But then also, I'm like, but if he doesn't recreate that one moment from the books, this is the Hush that they marketed. The entire Hush storyline was marketed on the figure that you received,
yeah,
with the bandaged face and the big trench coat and the two guns specifically. Like, it was all images from that middling issue that they used to sell this book.
Oh yeah.
So if I
ignore honestly, it's the replaceable parts.
Yeah.
If you ignore the replaceable parts, it is pitch perfect Thomas Elliot Hush for the rest of the comic series. It's just literally all of the add-ons, all of the additions to this, and like the ways in
which make it not that figure. And it's just like, it's beautiful, and everybody's losing their mind, and I'm like, you're kind of losing your minds over a marketing scheme that was used.
Yeah.
Like, specifically for this, I'm like, because this, but I saw it and I'm like, well, that's a nice looking Hush figure, and then I saw that stuff and I'm like, this is a Hush figure that I need. This is the gift for Seijin's birthday. It's arriving in October, and he will appreciate this on the level that this figure needs to be appreciated. And
it's like,
it warms my cockles to hear that it did that for you. Thank you.
It's like wanting a Creed action figure of Michael B. Jordan and getting the one from just that moment in Space Jam. And it's like, you're in the universe, and it's the joke that, and that's how they, it's fine. I love it.
Yeah, I thought of it. And, you know, it's Mayfex, and I don't know anything about it. I dipped a toe one more time. I don't own any Mayfex figures myself, but I dipped a toe last year to get Dale a Mayfex Spider-Man, because she was so upset that she couldn't get her Spider-Man to do the iconic Spider-Man pose of like hand down, hand back. She's like, none of them have enough poseability, and I found one that did, and I'm like, yeah, I'll do it. I'll pull the trigger on this one too, so that she can finally do it. And she loved it. She raves about it. So then when I saw that, and I'm like, one person in the world will appreciate this, and he would never get it for himself.
It's a gorgeous, it's a gorgeous figure, and it's super well made. All of the stuff that needs to be perfect is perfect. It's and all of the stuff that they needed to get wrong for me to love it as much as I do, because as Oliver Platt once told us in Bicentennial Man, it's all about the imperfections, right?
Yep. And I think that might actually be the reason why collectors are kind of losing their minds over it too.
Yeah.
Is because they chose to focus on the exact perfect imperfections to make it that iconic figure.
Oh, man. Amazing. So, speaking of imperfections, or maybe not, talk to me about Dread.
Metroid Dread. Do you mean Resident Evil 3.5?
I'm so happy you just said that. That was the best review I think you could have possibly given of that video game to me.
Yeah, because it's Resident Evil 3.5. And I wish that wasn't the initial thought that I had. Spoilers for Metroid Dread follow. You have a minute to run away. You have a minute to stop the podcast, because I'm going to spoil the very end of Metroid Dread right here, right now, on the 247th episode of the Say Report. Because if you only felt like this game was sort of like Resident Evil 3, but with Samus Aran instead of Jill Valentine, oh baby, just you wait.
Does Chris show up with a bazooka at the end that he throws you out of a helicopter and he's just like, just shoot it?
Well, that doesn't happen in... I mean, I've never played Resident Evil 3 original. I've played the remake.
Oh, no, I'm thinking of Resident Evil.
That's Resident Evil. That's the first one where that happens. I'm like,
it was more of a Jill Valentine joke than it was a Resident Evil 3 joke. I apologize. Gotcha.
Well, I just want to make sure that, like... And specifically talking about the remake, because, again, I've never played the original. So, spoilers for Metroid Dread, you had a minute to walk away. I vamped, baby, and now it's time to talk about it. And the final thing is, in Resident Evil 3... The remake that came out on April 3rd, 2020, just as the world was falling into chaos, the final fight is against Nemesis in its final form, and the way that you defeat it is by getting a giant laser and blasting it in the head.
Oh, and pushing batteries.
Well, then you have to push in batteries and everything like that, right? But the important thing is you get a giant laser and you shoot it in the head, and that kills it. The end of Metroid Dread. First of all, you fight a boss that is harder than 98% of the rest of the game, right? The other 1% that's as hard is the Emmy sections, which Emmy is sort of the nemesis of this game. They're robots that were sent to the planet ZDR in order to investigate what is believed to be the resurgence of X-parasites in the universe, and those robots went rogue, right? The robots we sent went rogue, so we need to send Samus Aran to deal with it. That's, like, the story of the game. And then you have to fight those rogue robots, and blah, 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 blah. And those moments are hard, but the game's hyper-generous with save points, right? Not save points, checkpoints. So if you die in one of the encounters with the robots, you literally respawn outside of the door you entered the Emmy area.
Yeah, in the room where it happens. I heard you were about to say it. You can say it.
Yeah, right. Well, shut up. So it's not the room where it happens, right? Because the Emmy regions, the Emmy areas are large. They're multi-paneled. And it's specifically the door that you enter from is where you'll respawn. Okay. So, like, there is a chance to lose some progress. But the big moment is eventually you get a weapon, and it's the only weapon in the game that is capable of hurting the Emmys. And so the basic design of Metroid Dread is you enter an Emmy area until you can find, like, a core operation unit, which pretty much looks like Mother Brain. And I don't know, there's nothing in the lore of the game that says it's related to Mother Brain, but you defeat these Mother Brain computers, and then you absorb from them an Omega Cannon, and then that Omega Beam can destroy the Emmy units.
Nice.
And that's the 1% that's harder than the final boss. That's the 1% that's harder in this game than the final boss. Because the final boss, I'm not going to lie, it took me about an hour to finally defeat it. And the big reason for that is, like, you don't get any indication if you're hurting it or not in the first section. First section, what you really need to do is wait it out until it attacks you, and then you need to use the parry move that was introduced in Samus Returns.
Yeah.
And then by using that parry move, that's how you can actually damage it. And then you do that like 2-3 times, depending on how much damage you're able to do in the sequence after you parry. And then it goes into, and then it's like a regular Metroid fight where anything can hurt it. But like figuring out the first section of the fight is very difficult. And then you get to the second section of the fight, and even though it's pretty much just learning the patterns that it's going to fight with during that fight, if you die, you go back to that first section again.
Okay.
And it's still sort of playing the waiting game until it does the one attack that you can parry.
Weird. Yeah. See, I'm kind of facing a same issue in just specifically in terms of a boss battle where they're not giving you enough information. I'm coming up against a lot of that throughout not Wind Waker, Skyward Sword.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically for anybody else that is keeping up with like any of the Garaheim parts, it's really hard to tell when the move you're making is the right one, because like he reacts, but it's not enough for you to think like you did any damage. He's like, oh ho, and you're just like, are you laughing at me because that didn't hurt, or are you laughing at me because I actually hurt you? I'm confused. Like, I need a little bit more than that. Like, I know that one of the big things about Dread is that it's being made by a newer company for Nintendo, right?
Mercury Systems, yeah.
Right? I don't mean to... part of me hopes that it doesn't mean that this is just like an inherent thing at like Nintendo over the last decade. Because I also had these thoughts a little bit when I was doing certain things with Mario Odyssey and stuff like that too. Like there were these moments where the feedback was not quite enough for my little pea brain to like quite figure out if I had done the right thing or not until, oh, okay, I guess I had. I will say I did not feel this at all. And I think the reason why I picked up on it so much in Odyssey specifically is because it was the first big major open world Nintendo game I had played after Breath of the Wild. And Breath of the Wild does such a good job of letting you know when an attack has done a certain amount of damage or a certain type of damage. So like, it's so good at that I noticed it in Mario and thought maybe I'm just overreacting because of how good it is in Breath of the Wild. And then I started to feel it in a couple of other games from Nintendo. And now suddenly hearing that it's in Dread 2, I'm starting to wonder if this is just like a boss battle issue that new Nintendo needs to fix up.
This is specifically an issue from other people who've talked about it. This is a Mercury Systems issue, the company, because the same sort of issue existed for people in Samus Returns for the 3DS. Like, I'm not sure when I'm doing damage. It feels like enemies are bullet sponges that like...
Until they're not, right?
Right.
Until that moment where suddenly, oh, I guess I won.
Yeah.
It's the weirdest catharsis of the world in a boss battle where you're like, I'm not doing anything. And then all of a sudden they're dead and you're just like, oh, I was doing something the whole time. Like, it takes some of the fun out of it.
Yeah. I mean, that's like the second fight against the final boss. He does a thing where he aims at you and then like shoots a Gatling gun. And what I was doing was I was circling him with the space jump, right? Like the iconic Metroid space jump. I would circle him. And then whenever I had a shot, I would shoot into him and then I'd continue space jumping around him. And like one time that I got to the third section of the fight, right? Cause it's a 3-section fight. Which eventually leads to that fourth section that makes this Resident Evil 3.5 that I still haven't talked about, is like one time it felt like I was doing that for like an hour. Like, and then eventually, oh, you did enough damage to move on. And another time it's like, oh, I did that 3 times and now we're at the final fight. And it's not like it was later on. It's not like the game rewarded me for being able to do it the first time. The first time that I did it, it didn't feel like it took as long as the second time that I did it.
Mm.
And then, like, you know, I'm already thinking Resident Evil 3 with this game, with the Emmys sort of tracking you like the Nemesis, the way that it does and all of that. I'm wondering, like, oh, is it because I have higher health this time that, like, it's gonna take more hits to hurt him? Does it have an adaptive difficulty going on in this? Right. And, like, that would be hellacious for a Metroid game, considering the fact that this is the first Metroid game where low percent is literally no percent clear. because the percentage of items collected does not include any of the stuff that you collect for traversion. So like the beams that you collect, the space jump, the power bombs, none of that counts towards your percentage of items collected. Only missile packs and power bombs that you find out in the world are, oh, and energy tanks contribute to that percentage. Because I was watching a guy yesterday who had been routing the game for 3 hours, and then eventually he found out, he's like, I have to there's no way out of here right now. I have to collect this missile pack. And that I just wasted 3 hours because they dropped it in my way. So unless I can find a way to not do this, I wasted 3 hours routing the game.
So he was trying to do a 0% run?
Yeah.
And got screwed because just something showed up just the wrong way? Like
just
RNG?
Not RNG. Just like he didn't realize that the way out of the room led you through a missile pack. So he's just like, oh, fuck. Like, what am I supposed to do? Like, if I had bombs, I could go out the other way, but I didn't collect bombs yet. Damn it. Like, what am I supposed to do? And it's just like, ooh, you feel that one. And, you know, and he went back and he rerouted it and he figured it out. But, like, that's been the story of this game, is people routing these runs of the game. But when you get to that final boss and you don't have any of the upgrades that you can collect along the way, it shouldn't be easier because you don't have any health. Yeah. It should be as difficult. Like, that's how Metroid works. So I doubt that there's any sort of adaptive difficulty on display, but like that's the thought process, is that, oh, I didn't take any damage this time, and he's taking a lot more hits to move on to the next cycle.
Oof.
Like I don't know how to feel about this. But you know, it is what it is. But the big thing, are you going to play this game? Am I going to ruin this game for you if I spoil what happens in this? Okay.
Go ahead.
So,
I mean, yes, I might play it, but no, you're not going to ruin it for me. Go.
So in Metroid Fusion, the fourth game in this series, right, in the 2D Metroid series, they find the X-Parasite, and the whole thing about the X-Parasite is Metroids were their natural predators. And since Samus has killed all the Metroids in the galaxy, now the X-Parasite is going to run rampant throughout the universe. And an X-Parasite infects Samus, and the only way to defeat it is to inject Metroid DNA into her body as a type of vaccination, and that allows her to absorb the X instead of being taken over by them. In this game, right, finally shutting up everybody who says that Metroid is the character in Metroid games, right, that it's not Sam, that people who think that, you know, like Zelda is Link, right? No, Link is not Zelda, right? Link is the main character. Samus Aran is not Metroid. Well, Samus Aran is Metroid now. Because being on this planet awakens the latent Metroid DNA and begins to mutate her into a full-on Metroid. So at the end of the game, she mutates into a full-on Metroid, as the final boss is absorbed by an X-Parasite and becomes a giant hulking figure. And what you have to do is launch a concentrated laser into its tiny head area until it explodes.
Oh, man.
So, overwhelmed female protagonist, constantly being chased by, like, unnerving, unwavering combatants. And then the final reveal is, you have to blow this shit up with a laser. That's just your only out. And that's why it's Resident Evil 3.5.
Excellent. So, well, that's, man, it's a weird choice. I mean, the idea, though, that they went the space action horror element is not too weird, though, right? Like, I mean, that's always been part of it. It just so happens that...
Well, I mean, Fusion did it better. I think that's the problem that I have with it overall, is that... So they cut off her power suit in Fusion, and the X that had taken over her body was able to reconstitute it and essentially become a clone of Samus.
Right.
And so it hunted her on the space station they were both on, the BSL station that they're both on in Fusion. And like that feels like an actual threat, because with Metroid DNA, Samus is now horrendously immune to cold, right? And the SAX, the Samus Aran X figure, has her ice beam power. So, like, if it shoots her once, she's going to die because she's now a Metroid. And, yeah, like, that's so how you kill Metroids.
So it's Mr. X in Resident Evil 2 to the Nemesis in Resident Evil 3.
Yeah, where, like, I mean, kind of. Because Mr. X can actually chase you and sort of appear anywhere.
Yeah.
Where the SAX is highly scripted in all of its encounters.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah. Game mechanic wise.
Yeah.
I'm talking about, like, storyline wise, which is always where my focus usually is.
Right,
more
no,
than
that's
anything.
Fine. Yeah, I understand. Yeah. It's yeah. something. I mean, because the Emmy sections, they spawn, that every time, every place they spawn when you enter their areas is RNG. Mm. Right? So you could walk through a door and it could be right there. And then you're like, oh, fuck. Or you can enter a door and maybe not see it until you've gone through two or three rooms.
Okay. So, like, what's the rest of the game like, though? Like as disappointing as some of this stuff might be, or cool. I mean, some people out there might be excited by a lot of the stuff that you've been saying, honestly. Like, it sounds like it is what it is with this game. But, like, what's, like, the exploration like? What's it like to go back and find new areas and things like that?
So, the exploration is a little clunky because the game is very linear. You're not really rewarded for exploration until after you've killed all seven Emmys. Again, maybe that's my interpretation of it. There are plenty of people out there who are now finding sequence breaks in the game, and that's exciting. But I was instantly shut off to it where I collected an item, and it was clearly one of the power bomb items. Right. And, you know, I'm coming from Super Metroid, right? I've played every Metroid, I've completed every Metroid, but Super Metroid is kind of my Metroid of the 2D Metroids.
Okay.
That's not surprising, right? Because Link to the Past is my Zelda, right? Super right. Nintendo is clearly, like, my system of choice for a lot of these things. And in Super Metroid, one of the best parts about it is if you can sequence break and get a power bomb or a super missile without doing the events that finally give them to you, you can use them as soon as they're collected. Right. So I get the power bomb and I'm like, oh yeah, power bomb. That's going to change how I approach all of these rooms, how I'm searching for, like, blocks to break and how I'm going to move forward over them. And then the screen comes up and it says, this is a resource that cannot yet be identified or used. So I'm able
at least
to...
At least they put a narrative reason in, but what a lame one.
Yeah, so, like, I can collect it, and I have a counter of question mark items, right? But it's one of those situations where, like, so I know power bombs are in the game, right? Because I've collected a power bomb, and you can collect your first power bomb very early on. Like, after defeating two Emmys, you can collect a power bomb item. If you're exploring and playing the game the way that, like, Metroid is meant to be played. But then until you defeat all seven Emmys, the last Emmy is the one that gives you the ability to use power bombs.
That's the worst. That's so disappointing. I mean, like, yeah. It's just weird to me because when I think about, like, the entire concept of the genre defying Metroid game, like, the idea that you can find this thing and then you don't get to just run around and play with it is, like, against the point, right? It just feels like it's against the whole heart of
right.
the thing.
Well, like, and that's why I was so surprising after I had finished the game and I got credits, right? And that's when I'm willing to look and see what other people are doing, that, like, there are sequence breaks and, like, very famously, like, on Twitter, if you're able to get the bombs before you fight Kraid, you can kill it in 30 seconds. Because there's a bomb launcher that will kill him when you launch Samus into his body. Like, it just rips through him. And it's like, that's cool that they, like, knew that this was a possible sequence break and have thus done this for the game, right? To reward people who do it. But then, like, as soon as I'm like, oh, I can finally get a power bomb, and then I'll have power bombs, right? And I felt like I was doing something cool because it required, like, an infinite bomb jump to get there. And I'm like, yeah, this is because I play Metroid and I understand the language of Metroid, to then be told, yeah, no, sorry, you can't use this until we tell you you can. felt very restrictive, and then like also made me feel like, so is that going to be every item that, like, until narratively I should have it, I can't use it? Like, it sent me the wrong message in terms of Metroid exploration. If that makes sense.
Yeah. No, I totally understand that. And it's the thing that I was really hoping we were going to get to see, like, the perfection of with this one. And maybe that's unfair. Maybe, like, you shouldn't expect video games to be perfect. But that idea of being that, like, this was going to be the return to form in a lot of ways for, like, Metroid games. This was going to be the thing that really kind of, like, reinvigorated that and to not get such a core element of the game, like, right for me. Like, I will play it eventually, but now I'm not interested in getting it today. Like I might've been if otherwise told, you know?
Yeah, I get that. I mean, the other issue is, and this is a Mercury Systems issue. This is not something that we saw prior to this, beginning with Samus Returns, because Samus Returns is a remake of Metroid 2 on the Game Boy, right? Mm-hmm. Which was a relatively small game, and it was designed to be played in handheld mode, right? Right. Save points are prevalent. They're everywhere. And the whole point is like, oh, here's a hub area. Go off these four different directions, kill the Metroids that are there. And then the lava that's beneath this section will drain and you can go deeper into the planet.
Right.
And so you kill one and then you come back here, you save. Oh, do I have time to go for another one? Or is my battery about to die? Right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's how it is.
Is the car ride almost over? Right. Yeah.
Like, that's how it's designed. And so Samus Returns, you know, it adds some other things to that. But the big thing that they did, and I don't know if it's to make it feel more like it's Big Brother's Super Metroid and Metroid Fusion, and even Zero Mission in a way, is to put in so many collectibles that it almost becomes ridiculous. And one of the ways that they add collectibles is missile packs. Up to this point have always added 5 missiles to your total, right? Beginning in Samus Returns, they add 2 to your total. And then occasionally in the world, you'll find a missile pack plus that adds 10. So like, rather than just having everyone add 5 and keeping the same amount, they divvy it up that way, so you have to find, there's more things in the world to find and to discover. Yeah. And I also wonder if that might possibly be inspired by something like Axiom Verge, which came out in that long space between Fusion and Samus Returns. And like, because that's what made Samus Returns seem like a viable game, right? Is people are still playing Metroidvania games. Why don't we, Nintendo, have a Metroid game out?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And man, so they try to do that. So like all of the collectibles in this game. And again, I know that about Samus Returns because I've played the opening of it. I've never finished Samus Returns. I didn't really like it because I had to play it on the 3DS and the parry thing, right? Like it didn't feel natural on the 3DS controls. It feels Samus controls like a dream in Metroid Dread. That is like the biggest praise that I will give to them is I feel like I'm in control of the character at every possible moment in the game.
Cool.
But
yeah, that's great. That's awesome.
Yeah. Especially some other games. I haven't felt that way. Right. Some other Metroidvania games that I've played this year. Right. Screw you, Kotaku. I'm going to use the term Metroidvania. You advocated for people emulating a game that was released on Friday in a Saturday article about it.
Oh, they corrected it.
They corrected it because they got called out for it.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I know. Yeah. Jackass.
Yeah. Right. Oh, so don't be coming down, Kotaku, saying Metroidvania is a terrible term and then be like, hey, you know that new Metroid game? You can emulate it. Right. That's the age we're living in. Same day emulation on modern games. That advocates.
The point of the article as it currently stands is a very good one, but it will forever be marred by the fact that it was definitely wrapped in a shit sandwich when they first put it out.
Yeah.
Idiots.
When they first put it out and being like, oh, have you looked at the Switch emulators? Like, I didn't know the names of any Switch emulators.
Guess what? I do know.
Now I do.
I know. And I like, look, you're never going to hear me defend
Kotaku,
like
yeah.
a large corporation that makes its money off of being shit out to the people that read it.
That's a good point. But yeah, so it's one of those situations where like control's like a dream, right? But again, I don't know about Samus Returns if this is a thing. Another thing that they've added is they went to Zelda and the whole heart container thing. Energy tanks now exist like that in Metroid Dread, where you need to find 4 energy parts to get a full energy tank.
Nice.
And there are still some energy tanks out in the world, like after you defeat bosses, which is like the full-on heart container you get when you beat bosses. But like, it also, it just feels like a way to pad the collectibles in this game to keep me playing it. As does the hard mode, which was something that was added, you know. I mean, that was added with Zero Mission. They added a hard mode to that game. But like, that, like, Metroids were, you know, they were a mix of challenge in that. And then the thing that I don't understand, and again, I know that people play video games differently, people are really talking about how challenging Metroid Dread is for them. And I don't understand how that could exist with this game.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about your ability to sight read games in general, never mind a series of games that is so near and dear to your heart, though, right? Like you, that's what you got to think about, is the fact that, like, this is literally in your blood. You know?
That's a good point, right? I'm going to become a Metroid at the end of the game. No, I think for me, the reason why is, like, it's hyper generous with the checkpoints. It's not like when you die, and I've played a lot of Metroidvanias this year specifically, where a death would mean like half an hour getting back to where I was.
For sure.
Because I hadn't found a save point.
Right, but if I instead spend that half an hour hitting a freaking brick wall because I can't get past this particular point, that can feel just as bad as having to retread my steps for 30 minutes. Especially because usually what took me a half an hour the first time, I can do in 10 minutes the second time. Which is
one
not
certainly
the case
hope,
when you've been knocking against a stupid boss and you think you're doing everything right. And yeah, so I can appreciate that. And look, I the real reason I'm doing this is to cover my ass here, because when I eventually play this thing, I will probably be saying those same things. Because I just don't play Metroid games.
Yeah,
they're
no, and I'm
not,
very, and
they're not
again,
something that I'm familiar with, you know?
I think it's going to be an interesting discussion when you do it. There are a lot of people where I'm like I contacted Zach about it, your brother, because he's playing. I'm like, have you found any difficult stuff? And I know that he played through the series in order to prepare for Dread, right? So he definitely would be ahead of the game in like learning the parts of it. And he's like, I mean, the Emmys give me difficulty, but it's just like any other boss fight where you try until you succeed.
Yeah, that jackass thought Death Stranding was fun. So what does he know?
Well, I wasn't going to call out Zach on this one, but it was just one of those situations where a lot of the people are saying that the repetition is the issue. And it's just, I guess what it proved to me, and the reason why I even bring it up in this discussion, is that people are never going to be happy in terms of what is difficult, because it really like at the end of the day, Metroid Dread feels like baby's first Metroid. And I don't mean anything rude about that. I'm not trying to be derogatory towards that. In the same way that Link's Awakening feels like baby's first Zelda, Metroid Dread feels like baby's first Metroid. It's supposed to be an accessible game that like gives you tutorials, make sure that you understand everything about this world and what you're supposed to be doing, right?
For sure.
Like understand that like you're going to have to come back to places once you have an item that will allow you to access this location.
Right. It's not that it's a baby game. It's that it's an accessible game, right?
Yeah.
Like the idea that the accessibility on it is key to the experience for a lot of people. Yeah.
And I think that that makes a lot of sense in terms of this is kind of meant to reinvigorate a franchise that has lain dormant for, I think, 19 years is when all is said and done. Because Metroid Fusion was the last like true 2D one that wasn't a remake. That was a new story. And like that game, I loved that game. It's the reason I got a Game Boy Advance. I've bought that game twice because I lost a copy of it in Las Vegas and got very disappointed about losing that game and being like, well, I get to play through it again, right? Silver lining. It's just like one of those situations. in a weird way. But like 19 years later, if you're going to do this game, you want to make sure, especially with the way that Nintendo is viewed now, right? The way Nintendo is viewed post the Wii, right, is family friendly and accessible. So any Metroid game that's going to come out is probably going to be family friendly and accessible. And they want to make sure that if you're somebody who bought this game just because it's a new Switch game, you're not going to be upset with it because it's too difficult or you don't know what to do in the game. Especially when we've been hearing rumors about Metroid Prime 4 coming to this system since the beginning of the Switch, right? Mm-hmm. This is to, like, get people interested, get people to understand this world, and then hopefully they'll buy Prime 4 when it eventually releases. It's basically a game that's marketing.
Yeah.
And it's playing a dangerous game in doing that because it has those longtime fans like myself who are expecting it to be that same level of difficulty that it has been the entire lifespan of the franchise for me.
Yeah, but it's that age-old question now. Is Nintendo being brave or are they being stupid? And we won't know until the sales numbers come in. is the answer to that. Yeah, man. I've heard that people that have their hands on it are enjoying their time with it. Questions arise for sure. You're not the first person to point out the elasticity of the difficulty can get a little weird, and for you that doesn't seem to be a huge deal, but for some people clearly it is. Like the fact that they go for an hour without like too much of a challenge and then suddenly they hit a thing that they can't defeat and they feel like an idiot. That's not a great way to map out your game, but you know, I don't know. I'm gonna definitely have to try it though. I think at this point I wanna wait until I get my hands on it.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, and I don't need to say anything else about it. I guess, but the thing about difficulty is, for a long time, everybody thought that the difficulty was, I don't have a checkpoint that starts me right back where I died, right? I need to reclaim that progress. And that's sort of like the Dark Souls discussion, right? In addition to the fact that, like, the bosses are hard, I lose my progress when I die because I don't start right back at the boss the way that most other modern games do.
Yeah, but that's just one way to make a game hard.
Right, exactly. But that's one discussion of why a game is difficult, right? So then when you come to a game like Metroid, and their thought is, okay, so we hear these people who are saying, losing my progress is what bothers me. So we have save points, but then we have checkpoints that are literally the door before the boss. Mm-hmm. That's every boss. When you lose, you start right back at that boss. But you don't start in the arena. You have the option to go back and maybe get some more missiles. Maybe get some more health upgrades. And I don't know. Like, it's like people are never going to be happy in terms of the difficulty discussion.
Yeah.
Be it the people who are like...
But that's because you can't think about people as an obelisk. There are going to be people out there that prefer it one way and find it easier to do it this way than there are people that are going to have an issue with that. So that's the thing, is you can't please everybody because everybody's a different person.
Very true, Seijin. And quite poignant, too. Sort of puts a nice bow on everything we're talking about. I mean, do I recommend Metroid Dread? I do, right? If you're looking for something to play on your Switch, it's a fun game. It's an enjoyable game. It's definitely nowhere near game of the year for me. I will say that, right? And I think it's because I never got mad at it. I never got mad at Metroid Dread and then had that push through moment. I didn't have a romantic comedy relationship with Metroid Dread, right? We were just friends the whole time through. Where like Cyber Shadow, we had that third act breakup. Yeah. And then I realized, no, but like maybe I was just tired. Maybe I was expecting something from this game that it wasn't ready to give me. I'm going to give it another shot. And then I go out and, you know, for a while I'm third in the world on the 100% clear of the game. Like, it happens that way. Like, how I snuck that in there? Was it subtle enough for you?
Oh man, subtlety goes out the window at the 2-hour mark for me.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, but I think that's it. So it's worth it. There are some complaints there. The story wise, it totally makes sense, everything that happens in terms of story. So if you're looking for a continuation from the world of Fusion, there's some great like twists and things that I didn't talk about here because of how good they are. her turning into a Metroid, I don't think that's a great twist, right? It really just feels like someone in the room's like, you know how people call Samus Aran Metroid? What if we made her a Metroid? Right? That'd be hilarious.
Yeah.
Like that one doesn't feel like a thing. But like other things that happen in this game, like big thumbs up. Like good storytelling, well crafted experience.
Cool.
And I'm going to try it. I'm still trying 100% it. I haven't done that yet. So I'm still working at that. It's still getting attention from me. But yeah, that's it. So there we go. That's that. Anything else that you'd like to add, Siegen, before we send this one off?
No, man. Yeah, this has been a weird week in the world. So I apologize if it turned into a weird episode. But I am happy that we could start moving on from the internet shitting the bed on me all over last week.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, maybe a weird episode, but I think right in the name, we're a show about everything. And, like, I'm glad that we dug into some of the stuff that we discussed this week, right? What I am going to recommend, this is a real recommendation. This is a good, like, last thing before we send it off to Will. Fatal Fury is a game series from the 90s. It's a fighting game series. It's SNK Neo Geo's answer to Street Fighter. And just like the Street Fighter series had a movie, Fatal Fury had a movie, right? Only it was animated and it was anime. And it had a sequel to that movie. And then those did so well that a third movie was made called Fatal Fury the Motion Picture. And currently on Amazon Prime Video, if you have Amazon Prime Video, you have access to this. It is listed as Fatal Fury, and it says 1992, which is the year that the original Fatal Fury animated film came out. The description for that is of that movie, which is basically a recreation of the first game. This guy, Geese Howard, comes into town, and he wants to fight the strongest people in the world. And Terry Bogart, Andy Bogart, and their friend Joe Higashi fight against him and his tournament of fighters. And it's, you know, it's a basic, like, fighting game story adaptation. That's not what's there on Amazon Prime. It is Fatal Fury the Motion Picture. Garou Detsetsu is the original Japanese title of it. That one goes off the fucking rails. Amazing. To the fact that it is a dark storyline. There is some anime nudity that I was not expecting when I went to click on the 1992 one. And it's like, you know, not rated, but like recommended for all ages. And then like, oh shit, there's my Shinryu and she's naked for some reason. I wasn't expecting that in this. Check it out before Amazon realizes their mistake is what I'm going to say. Because it is a cool story. It has new characters. It does not follow any of the games, except for having Terry, Andy, Joe, and Mai. And then, like, you see some other fun cameos of characters. But, like, the people that they're fighting, it's a whole new, like, story. And it's cool. And it's kind of like the Infinity War storyline in terms of we have to find these six items to become a god. It's very good, and it's worth checking out. And Amazon's eventually going to realize that they linked the wrong movie and probably tear it down. So check it out if you have the opportunity.
Check it while it lasts. Yeah, man. Yeah. That's awesome. Good All find. Right.
So if you would like to talk about Siegen, about other small esoteric moments in comic book history that have been immortalized in action figure form, he can be found on Twitter at Siege versus the World.
And if you know of any other places where Devin can check out PG-rated films that suddenly have anime nudity in them, you can hit him up at Devin D. Decker.
Siegen, those girls have got the boom. Anime babes that make me think the wrong thing. How can I help it if I think you're funny when you're mad? Trying hard not to smile, though I feel bad. I'm the kind of guy who laughs at a funeral. Can't understand what I mean? Then you soon will. Bring us home. Because I don't want to get sued by the Bare-Naked Ladies. Have a good night, folks.
Thank you for listening to the Say Report with your host Devin Decker and Siegen Serwick. Please follow the guys on Twitter and Facebook by searching for the Say Report, and you can always subscribe on your podcast channel so this is delivered straight to you and you can enjoy it every week. With apologies to your mother, we'll see you next time.